It's part of it. So we're talking today about British civic law, which sounds like it might be one of the more boring sections of this, but in actuality, it is not. And I think what you're going to find, I'm going to do my best not to lead you into any conclusions, but what you're going to find is as we go through this, questions are going to start coming up in your mind about the two separate sides of the American Revolution and who was actually the enforcer of the law and who was the disobeyer of the law. So pay attention to that, and I'm not going to point out those specific things, but I want you guys to take note of that as we go through. So I have up there one of the greatest misunderstandings in American Revolutionary history is the paradox between American loyalty to the Crown and their separation from England. How can the British colonies profess their loyalty even after the battles of Lexington and Concord in sending the Olive Branch petition, which we'll talk about, and saying we are loyal British subjects, but we have grievances. We would prefer to remain loyal British subjects after they've already fought the British. That's such a paradox. They're rebelling against British rule while they're saying we want to be part of the British Empire still. And this misunderstanding is rooted in more of a English or British point of view of the American Revolution, that the Americans were these rebellious, not necessarily subhuman, but certainly beneath the high and mighty British and their approach to governing. That the colonists were, these frontiersmen, merchants, middle class people, a collection of middle class people, who certainly didn't know how to govern themselves, and were disobeying outright, and just basically they looked at like the different American revolutionary movements like the Sons of Liberty and were like, oh, these are terrorist organizations, essentially. And they should be done away with, the insurrection should be put down as violently as possible, and these rebels will be an example to the rest of the empire. Not the case. So we're going to start all the way back in 1215 with the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is one of the most important government documents in history, and that is because for one of the first times you have a documented, almost a constitutional setup for a government. And in 2021, we're so familiar with constitutions and writing laws down that we just take it for granted. But enumerated rights, listed rights for a government, and saying you can do this, but you can't do this, even back in 1215, certainly back in 1215, is a completely foreign concept. All right, the Roman Catholic Church has its fingers in politics. I tell my kids this in world history when we talk about the Reformation. The Roman Catholic Church, during the Middle Ages, even before that time period, certainly during this time, all the way up into the 1600s, and other state churches, they're political entities, more so than they are religious institutions. And it depends on who the Pope or the Archbishop is at the time. But a lot of times, the Roman Catholic Church is more of a political institution than it is even religious. And so writing down what kings can and cannot do is an affront to the Roman Catholic Church and their sponsorship of kings. Because if they sponsor kings, they only have to control one person. And the Pope is wielding international power from his seat in Rome, saying, well, God wants the king to do this. Okay? And God has put the king in power. I only have to control one person if I'm the Pope, if there's a king or a queen. But if the people suddenly rise up and say, oh, well, actually, we need to have three branches of government. Or actually, we need to allow people to vote on that. No. That's not how the Roman Catholic Church works, is it? I mean, you have a very definite series of authority from the Pope down, and it's not up to the common Catholic to determine what the church should and shouldn't do. They have no voice in that. More so, they have a voice today, but that's because of the evolution of the Catholic Church. And them, today, they would say this isn't the case, but they have essentially left their roots as a very dictatorial entity themselves. So what does it do? Well, it declares that the monarch was actually subject to the rule of law. And this begins the idea that the law is actually supreme as opposed to the monarch. okay? Because the monarch rules through divine right, according to the Catholic Church. Because of God's placement, and they emphasize very strongly the verses in the New Testament, which are still misapplied today, about how God has placed people in power in power. And so the Catholic Church says, oh, well, the royal family is the one in power. And so you have to do everything he says, or else you're not just disobeying the king, you're disobeying God. And so you have kings like Louis the 14th, who elevate themselves to a position of almost divine themselves. The divine rules through me. And so when you say, that's actually a really bad decision, you're not saying that about me, you're saying that about God. How similar is that with the Pope? When the Pope, and they haven't done this for decades, and I think it's even been centuries, but when they speak ex cathedra from the chair, what does the Pope, anything the Pope says is now inspired truth. Okay, so are you seeing the similarities between the Catholic Church and the setup of the monarchy? And so then the Protestant Reformation happens, and the Catholic Church is like, whoa, this is not just religious. This is going to change everything about society. Okay, because you're supposed to take the king's word because he's speaking as God. You're supposed to take the Pope's word because he's speaking as God. And you're all just common people. You don't get a voice in any of that, your religion, your government, anything. It documents the liberties held by free men, and we have to specify what that is. So it gives specific rights to both free men and the unfree peasantry. We're still at the stage where you have indebted peasantry. This is feudalism, which actually is still how some societies operate today. Land ownership is reserved for nobility. Okay, land ownership is not the right of just any person, so you can't just purchase land like you can in the United States. This is part of the reason that so many immigrants came to the United States. But you can just go to a land office, say you want land, and the government will just say, oh yeah, here's the deed, here's your land. You can just go to somebody and say, hey, I want to purchase this land from you. You can just have that transaction, and you're a landowner. In Europe, you don't get to do that. Okay. But it is going to enumerate those rights for both free men and unfree peasantry. And going to say, okay, like you know, this is how we're going to try certain people, and not giving the king just kind of free will to say, oh, off with your head, off with your head. This document is sometimes ignored. Okay. And the reason is that the Magna Carta written for the British government in the 1200s, Parliament exists in a very idealistic way, more so than a very practical way. And so King John feels the pressure, because there's the threat of war, to accept the Magna Carta, and so he signs it, but then he immediately goes, no, I don't want to do any of that. No. And guess who comes to his rescue? The Roman Catholic Church. And Pope Innocent III declares this document, which I've considered one of the most important government documents in history, null and void of validity forever. Is he the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church or the Pope of the country of England? Yes. Yes. He is not willing to limit the power of his monarch, because who does he have in the palm of his hand? The monarch. So this is corruption from top down. And King John, not a good king for England. And this is part of the reason of that.
Yes, sir. Who are the authors of the Magna Carta?
So the Magna Carta is actually it's a document that's written up by other powerful nobility in England. And the reason that King John feels that he's forced to accept it is because during this time, the royal families of these nation states are not solidified. So you could have, yes, a royal family, like today it's the Windsor family. But what happens if another royal family suddenly says, oh, actually, we have the right to claim the throne? We have wars going on. You have the War of the Roses, you might have heard of. Royal families arguing over who actually gets the throne of the King of England. All right, so King John is looking at this and going, well, I don't really want war. And so the nobility that say, we're going to limit your power, I kind of feel pressured into doing this, or else they're going to start fighting me for my claim to the throne. And it does go back and forth. So the royal family today has not been the royal family throughout the entire history of England. And we'll touch on that and its stupidity later.
Brandon,
yes?
This is the time when Richard was fighting the Crusades.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, and there's a lot of legend around that. But yeah, Richard the Lionhearted, he's out in the Crusades. King John has taken his place. Richard comes back, displaces King John, and then, you know, kind of in a very romanticized sort of way. But yes, that's correct. Okay, Petition of Right. We're going to jump ahead about 400 years to 1628. So you have a royal family that is ruling, and this is the Stuart family. They're from Scotland. And there's some sort of relation that they just kind of pulled from. They're like, why don't you come down and do it? So you have James the First. And those of you that have King James Bibles, you get to thank him for that translation. He does do some good things, like the translation of the Bible into the vernacular of the time. But overall, he is an absolute monarch who claims to rule by divine right. He enforces the will of the Anglican Church, which, of course, is going to be very possessive and controlling over the practice of certain of the Christian religion. So if you go to James II and then his son Charles I, he is also an absolute monarch, just like his father and grandfather before him. And the Petition of Right is very much like the Magna Carta in that you have parliament or a group of nobility that's saying, what you're doing, we disagree with, and you need to accept these changes. So here are the changes that were imposed. No taxation without the consent of parliament. So the king can't just say, I want to go on an expedition to invade France, like Henry VIII did, and you all have to pay for it. I'm not going to pay for it out of my own pockets, and we're going to start raising taxes. Parliament says, no, you need the people's approval to do that, and so we're going to take the power of taxation away from you. You can propose a tax, but if Parliament doesn't approve it, then it's not going to pass. No imprisonment without cause. So you can't just get on the king's bad side and suddenly go to jail. That's not how that works. You have to actually accuse somebody of a crime. No quartering of soldiers. You cannot impose the keeping of soldiers on the private citizen. And this is part of the Petition of Right. And then no martial law. You can't declare martial law, march your troops into the villages of England and say, all of your local forms of government have now become null and void, and you are under military law. That's what martial law is. A more modern example of that is the South after the Civil War during Reconstruction. The radical Republicans that controlled government after Lincoln's assassination imposed that martial law, which set the United States back decades and decades of progress because of that imposition of dividing the South into districts under that fierce military law. It is not the same. Okay? If you go to court, if you go to military court, the punishment and the accusations are going to be very severe. If you go to civil court, there's some variance there. Okay, you might be accused of stealing, but maybe the jury decides, in this certain case, we're just going to do community service, limited jail time, something like that. Military court is not like that at all. Okay? The punishments handed down are a lot more severe. So you can't declare martial law, have people tried in military courts, that sort of thing. So during this time, the king has the power to summon and dismiss parliament. It's not always in session. Today, in England, parliament is in session whenever it decides it's in session. And the prime minister controls the state. During this time, Charles says, fine, you want to limit my right? And the funny thing is that he signs the Petition of Right and agrees with it for the same reason that John agrees with Magna Carta. He's like, I don't really want war. But then he backtracks and goes, oh, no, I'll just dismiss Parliament. If you want my approval and you want to do all this stuff to me, then fine. Just dismiss you and I'm going to call you back together. So this is where you get the English Civil War. This is the Roundheads led by Oliver Cromwell, who was on our cover slide. Go back to that. So there's Oliver Cromwell. He was a Puritan. How many of you have ever heard the name Oliver Cromwell? Just raise your hand. Okay, and keep your hand up if you feel that Oliver Cromwell is a positive figure in history. It does, you're right. I hate asking questions like that because I hate answering questions like that. What does that mean? Everybody makes good decisions and everybody makes some bad decisions. Overall, we would agree with Oliver Cromwell, generally speaking, on his religious beliefs. But the Oliver Cromwell of the English Civil War, once he leads the Roundheads and actually defeats Charles I, Charles I is beheaded by the Roundheads at the end of the Civil War. Okay, and this is 1628. This is 150 years, roughly, before the beginning of the American Revolution. And think about the hilarious position that the English are put in. You can't defy the king, you stupid American colonists. You can't do that. The American colonists are going, 150 years earlier, you beheaded the king. We're not even going after the king. We just want to rule under British common law. That's all we're asking. And you guys are throwing a fit. We don't care. We don't want to behead George III. We have nothing but respect for him. We just think that what he's doing is wrong. So it's kind of funny that you have this blatant disregard for their own history. That just 150 years earlier, this violent civil war takes place where the British are fighting each other in the beheading of the anointed king of England. It's unreal and is completely unprecedented in European history. So Charles feels forced to accept the limit on the power. He resists it, and that's what the English Civil War results in. But Oliver Cromwell, after he comes to power, becomes a tyrant in his own right. And so you kind of go back and forth. You go, yeah, the Puritans are kind of our Christian ancestors. And so we feel bad kind of criticizing Oliver Cromwell. Don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. He's a person in history just like everybody else is, and he's subject to our analysis just like anybody else is. So it's not anything against the Puritan religion to say Oliver Cromwell wasn't the best statesman in British history, because he just simply wasn't. Yes? Mm-hmm. I think that's a great example of that. Oliver Cromwell leading the Roundheads is much different than Oliver Cromwell in charge of the parliamentary control of England. So there's actually no monarch during this time. And once again, we have a historical example of the people saying, we don't want a king, we want to do it our own way. And then one generation later, they're like, hey, you know what would be a great idea? A king. Should do that. And so you have actually Charles I's son, who's in exile in France, who's called back. Hey, please, please. He goes, well, you beheaded my dad, but I want to be king. So he comes back. It's a different time for sure. So the Church of England, we already talked about this a little bit. The Protestant religions are what is going to kind of throw a wrench into this whole system of absolute monarchy and control by a state church and those types of things. Yes, Megan. So from the Puritans as a whole are actually a fairly congruent group. I don't know a lot about a lot of fracturing. And it's interesting that you say that, because if you look at the Puritan colonies in the Americas, some of the most tyrannical colonial governments are the Puritan colonies. And so it's very interesting that you have the exact same example of a Puritan control of government in England, and then you have instances like the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts, and that's a Puritan colony. You go, something's not right here. There's something wrong. And I wouldn't even be able to tell you this is exactly what's corrupting Puritan control of government. Maybe you have something to add to that.
Well, Dr. Beal wrote a book, David Beal. He was here for the FBI. Uh-huh. Interesting man. But he wrote a book on Baptist history in England. The Baptists started in around 1620, 1640, separate. Regular Baptists, I think, then separate Baptists. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Calvinistic and the Arminian started right at the same time.
Well, I think
had a tough go. Cromwell's army had a lot of Baptist quote generals, and they did well for a while. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon he turned on them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of history there to read.
And usually what you have is a corruption of a good movement, and then the people that were a good group in the movement go, well, we can't associate with this anymore, and so they separate. And so then you have the Pilgrims, who are separatists, and the Puritans, who would be sort of their Baptist antithesis, if that's historically accurate. The Separatists are like, no Anglican Church, and the Puritans are like, well, maybe the Anglican Church, but not so much Catholic stuff in it. And it's kind of interesting there, the relation. Yes.
So where, I might be wrong on my time period, but where does Cromwell fit in with Cornwallis and King George?
So, yeah. Yeah, so you got 150 years difference.
Okay.
Yeah, so 1620s, 1630s is going to be the English Civil War. And then the American Revolution starts in earnest in 1775 with the battles of Lexington and Concord, which is also kind of weird in our American timeline. We think Declaration of Independence, and then the war. It's not the case. And actually, the Boston Tea Party is 1773. So this is a process. That's actually a major point that I'm going to make in the coming weeks. Yes.
Wasn't the Bangkok Compact 1620?
Yes. Yeah, right around the same time. And Mayflower, that's going to be separatists, just to clarify for the group. I'm sure you know that. But separatists, pilgrims are separatists, not Puritans. And so it's also very interesting to see how important the Mayflower Compact is in equality under the law, and also how efficient the Plymouth colony was as opposed to their Puritan brothers in New England. Those separatist colonies flourished, while the Puritan colonies kind of had to get over their tyrannical bend, controlling what people can and can't do.
Mm-hmm. I just, going back to the 1500s, did the Anabaptists have any influence? I know they did over, you know, like France and Germany and places like that, but did they play into any of this at all?
Yeah, mostly in the fact that they're the predecessors of a lot of these other movements, and I am not as up to date on my religious Baptist history. I have more of a knowledge of the Reformation and how that goes. So, but you do have Huguenots in France who are Protestant, who are subject to the rule of the Bourbon royal family, who are supported by people like Richelieu, who is a Catholic cardinal who's trying to consolidate royal power under the Bourbon family, and so they war against the Huguenots. So I'm not sure how the Huguenots fit into Anabaptists, but the Huguenots are French Protestants, and maybe, you know, there's some relation there. But most of this is going to center on the British and English factor of it, because we could get into the Calvinists in Switzerland, we could get into the Lutherans in northern Germany, but when we're talking about the American Revolution, most of that's going to focus on religious movements that are within the boundaries of England or Great Britain. So, yes, yes, ma'am. Okay, so the English Bill of Rights, this is a very fundamental document for the Americans. The Glorious Revolution takes place after the British once again realize their mistake in bringing back an absolute monarch. So they bring back Charles I's son. He ends up having another son who, I believe it's James the second or James III, and he is, his health isn't very good, and he dies at a young age. But they force him off the throne because they see that it's going to be just essentially more of the same type of bend towards absolute monarchy. They're not very efficient rulers. It's mostly just we're happy to be here type of thing. And so they go to the Netherlands, and they ask William and Mary. William is Dutch. His wife Mary is English royalty. And they ask them to come back. And Mary says, only if we can rule jointly. So it's the only time in British history where you get joint rule between a king and a queen. And so in history books, you're always going to see William and Mary together. The reign is not King William's reign. It's William and Mary. And the Glorious Revolution is called that because it's bloodless. William and Mary come to claim the throne. The descendants of the Stuarts do not resist that. So they go into exile, and you have William and Mary, who are all too willing. They're great rulers, loved by the British, their British subjects, and they accept the English Bill of Rights. But this is a massive limitation on monarchical power. And it emphasizes the points outlined in the Petition of Right, but you have some key additions. The monarch can't override laws of Parliament, so who is now supreme, Parliament or the monarch? Parliament. You can't keep a standing army during peacetime, which is interesting when you get into World War I and World War II, and you see the state of the British army during that time. It's like several thousand foot soldiers, several thousand before World War I. Crazy to think about. hardly any, and protected freedom of speech. Okay, so those are key parts of the Bill of Rights. Okay, so here's the question. Which side is abiding by these documents of British law during the American Revolution? And next, I'm going to stop here because if you guys want to discuss this, this is going to be one of the lessons where you have a little bit more time for questions. And if I have time, I'll start the formation of American colonies and the French and Indian War. But anything, any questions? Let's keep it limited to questions because discussion kind of just gets us off course. But any questions about British civil law or civic law? Questions about that? You guys are just itching for more information. Jaden?
So the provisions to, like, you know, like the serfs and the free people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did the American colonists enjoy the same benefits?
Actually, more so, because you don't have the same classes in the American colonies as you do in England. Because feudalism classifies people into those categories, whereas when you're founding the American colonies under British common law, you see a limit of those classes. And this is, we were talking about the 1619 Project on the way to church this morning. This is where the 1619 Project completely misses the mark. Because if you're looking at the freest society in the entirety of the world during the formation of the English colonies, you'd have to go into the Americas, where people are classless in a way that no one else in the entire world at the time, even the most advanced countries, certainly Britain, if you come over to the American colonies, what you work for is what you get. And there's not going to be nobility and those types of things. There's just going to be people. So that's a good question. Yes?
What about the indentured servants and the prison camps in Georgia?
So prison camps in Georgia are mostly for British people who actually have broken the law. So it's not so much as, it's not like a concentration camp. So much as it is like you've broken the law and so your punishment is going to go to Georgia, a prison colony. You're going to work there. Georgia is, and you're touching on something I'm going to talk about. It's a royal colony, so it's directly under the rule of royal interests. And so they use Georgia as a colony to further whatever the crown wants to do. Indentured servitude is actually a great way for people from Britain to come over to the colonies. Because what they'll do is that they know that there's large plantations, especially in the south. And so they'll say, I can't afford to get over to the New World, but I really want to. And so what they'll do, they'll come over on the ships and they'll say, I will work for you for this many years, at which point you're going to provide simply my house and my food, and I'll work for you. And so the exchange for me is that I get to work in a place where I can get ahead, but I'm not getting paid. And then in, you know, 7, 8, 10 years or whatever, then they're granted their freedom, and they can now purchase land because they've paid off their debt to their, you know, whoever they were working for. Yes? And that's an agreement, but that's a legal agreement that they put themselves under. Nobody's forcing that on them. Now, of course, you do have slaves that are purchased, and you do have several examples of slaves essentially doing the same thing. You have indentured servitude. Crispus Attucks, who's widely considered the first casualty of the American Revolution, was a freed black man. 1773? There's black people in Americas that are free? Yeah. 1619 Project, why don't you look at that? So... And this is, I'm good, I don't want to get ahead of myself. But what the point I was going to make is this is 1773. This is a former slave in Boston, which is a heavily white community at the time, who is fighting alongside who? White people for the exact same cause. Okay? He just works. He's upset at the British. And so he's at this protest alongside a bunch of other black people? No. And so it's this perfect example of how the United States, even in what people would consider was its most racist time, was far less racist than the Spanish colonies, to be certain. And are they upset that this Crispus Attucks is protesting alongside of them because he's African? No. Nobody in Boston cares because he's of the same mindset as them. That's America. We don't really care what your race is. We want you to come here and say, I'm American because I believe in the founding rights, everything that we're going through. I believe in freedom of expression. I believe in freedom of speech. I believe in not being forced to make personal decisions by that. So it doesn't really matter what your race is. Are you a part of our culture of freedom? And if you're not a part of that, that's where the issue comes in. Okay? Not so much in the race as those things. So I did that to myself. I got off on the rabbit trail. That's not your fault, Carol. Okay, I'm going to move on. Is it 40 or 45? Okay, I got permission. We have 7 more minutes. Hopefully you're not. Thank you. That's right. You took 5 minutes away from me, so I get the additional 5. All right, so let's... it's his fault. So there's 3 different ways that colonies can be founded in Britain. First way is a charter colony. Second way is a royal colony. Third way is a proprietary colony. I'm going to do the best to give you the differences here. A charter colony is going to be... let me get the next point up there. So each of these is a legal way under British law to form a colony. So don't get the sense that some people are being sneaky about this. They're like, oh, we're going to start a colony. You can't do that. Okay? The land is claimed by Britain, so you have to go to the British government and say, I need a charter. I need your permission to start a colony in the New World. So these are mostly companies. Okay? Joint stock companies, just like we have today. So free trade in the sense that people can buy stock in these companies. They're going to the British government and saying, we want to start a colony to further our business. Maybe they're in timber trade. Maybe they're in the trade of cotton, of any sort of grain. But they want to start a colony for the furtherance of their company. And so they get permission, a charter, to do that. And what happens is people who are sponsored by this company will come over, and the agreement is you're going to have a relationship with the joint stock company, and you're going to further their interests legally. And what happens is the people that are part of this charter will set up their own type of self-governance. Okay? Because nobody's there babysitting them. You go, well, we're going to have some sort of rule of law. So they adopt English common law, and they say, English Bill of Rights, Magna Carta, Petition of Right, all of those founding principles of the English idea of how to rule somebody, they use all of that, they smush it together and say, this is how we're going to do it. And nobody's going, wow, this is such a new way to do it. They go, oh yeah, we're familiar with all that. Okay, voting rights and all this kind of stuff. Okay, now it is more liberal in a good way, more liberal in the English colonies, but nothing wrong with it. Royal colonies are like Georgia, which was a prison colony, but it's directly... it's serving the direct interests of the crown. Okay, so you don't have a company in there that's kind of, saying, oh, we need more of this type of export or anything like that. Whatever interest the king has, that's what the colony is serving. Then you have a proprietary colony. This is where perhaps nobility would go to the parliament, whatever parliamentary office is in charge of colonies or the crown themselves, and they would say, I want permission to found a colony. And I'm going to found a colony in this. Can you give me permission? And most of the time, it's people who are very closely related to the English crown. William Penn, okay, Pennsylvania is a proprietary colony. Okay, William Penn founded the colony, Pennsylvania. He didn't own a business, necessarily. Like, it wasn't serving his business interests. It was his colony to found, and he founds it as a commonwealth. In a very familiar way, same way, English common law, so very similar. Okay, so Georgia is an example of a prison colony, or a royal colony. Charter colony would be like Massachusetts. So they're all legal establishments. So none of the colonies are operating illegally at any point in American history. That's important to note. Right? That doesn't mean everybody follows the law and everybody in America has a halo and they're like, oh, we're perfect. We don't do anything wrong. But the colonies themselves are operating on a completely legal standing. They're very similar. We already went over some of the differences between there. So, this is going to be the fastest French and Indian War. yes, sir. Yes. Yeah, they did. And that was religiously based. Yeah. So you get some of that, those people that don't like the persecution, religious persecution they're receiving, even in the American colonies. We're going to go start our own. So they have to get a charter for that. Yep. Okay, so French and Indian War, the causes of it. I'm going to go through this very quickly, so it's going to be very simplified. American colonists are settling in the Ohio River Valley. That's an area that the British are like, hey, don't settle there. So what do the Americans do? Move west. That's what we do. Go west. Really, Horace Greeley, go west, young man, right? So they settle there, but the thing is that there's French settlers that are in the exact same area, and so this is a clash. Who's going to claim this land that is previously unclaimed? The British don't claim it, the French don't claim it, everybody wants it, and so you get this animosity between the two groups. The French and Indian War is called that because it's the British and the Americans together on one side fighting the French and their Indian allies. Okay, so it's not the French and the Indians fighting. It's the French and the Indian allies against the Americans and the British. This is where we get introduced to George Washington, Fort Necessity. He kind of makes a name for himself because he's really good at retreating. Sounds weird, but it's actually true. Retreating is one of the things that very few generals know how to do correctly. George Washington did know how to do that. And so the British were like, wow, this guy has a lot of promise. Fort Necessity is built out of necessity, and they go, this guy, he's going to be really good. And the Americans are like, no, he's ours. Can't take him. We're going to use him. You get major battles like the Battle of Quebec, where has been severely romanticized, but I don't have a lot of time to go into that. The results of it, though, is that the British are looking at the Americans going, this is all your fault. Americans, we just got done with the French and Indian War, where we fought alongside of you, died alongside of you, and we fought your arch nemesis over the past several centuries. What are you talking about? It's our fault. If you guys weren't such jerks to France all the time, and they're looking at the 7 years war in Europe, which is its Eastern Hemisphere cousin, it's happening at the same time. The 7 years war is between Britain and France. What do you mean you're blaming us for all this? Right? We were settling in land that we believe we had a right to claim, and the French are the aggressors. Of course, that's how everybody always looks at it. It's always somebody else's fault. That's debatable. But the Americans don't want to take all the blame for that, and they help the British defeat their enemy. So why is it that the Americans are thereby getting punished through all of the taxation? And this is where you get the beginning of the, because the French and Indian War is 1750s. So basically immediately after that, you have a fractured relationship between these two countries where they're imposing taxation on them. The Americans don't feel that on a fundamental basis they should have to pay. And that is a story for next week. So we'll get into that and kind of the legal basis for the taxation and some of the other issues that the Americans have. I don't have time for questions, but if you'd like to discuss this, I'd like to discuss it with you. So you can come up to me afterwards, and we'll continue our conversation, okay? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this opportunity to share historical fact and objective truth, hopefully in a way that people can understand the founding of this country and where our roots are. I pray that everything would be done through the lens of your word, and that we would be learning all of this, as Pastor said this morning, as a foundation to the true application to our lives, which was the American Revolution justified on a biblical level? And so, Lord, I pray that you'd help us to understand that, even as we understand the historical context. In Jesus' name, amen.